Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources for March 27, 2003 is hereby convened. We welcome all of you. Just to put your minds at ease in regards to House Bill 3308, if you are here for that purpose today, that bill is not going to move out of this committee in its current form and is likely to be drastically altered. So if you are here to passionately advocate for or against that bill, forget about it. It's okay. We'll still hear from you if you really want to, but it isn't going to come out of here looking the same way it does today, and that is an agreement amongst all of the parties involved. So I will leave it up to you as to whether you want to continue with your passionate testimony on this issue. However, it is an important issue, and we are going to hear the bill. So before we go any further, I again want to bring your attention to our sign-up sheet. If you are a government official and a lobbyist, you, by signing this sheet, hereby recognize you are governed under two ORSs regarding truthful and accurate testimony. If you are here from the public, this does not apply to you. However, we still want your testimony to be truthful and accurate. So having said that, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3308. Ray, you want to tell us what this does briefly?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3308 imposes a surcharge on seed dealer license and nursery licenses. It directs the proceeds to weed control programs. It imposes a $1 port surcharge on shipping containers offloaded in the state. Provides for transfer of money collected by the ports for use in controlling aquatic weeds and invasive species. It transfers proceeds from a surcharge on Crater Lake license plates to the State Department of Agriculture for weed control programs. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have a dash one amendment before us, which removed reference to the Crater Lake license plate program and transfer funds from that program to the State Department of Agriculture. And Mr. Chair, we do have Senator Atkinson here to testify to the bill.
Welcome, Senator Atkinson. Come forward, please. And I can assure you, members, that, like I said, this bill will look very different in the near future than it does today. Welcome, Senator. Good to have you here. Geez, 2 days in a row, or actually 2 hearing days in a row. Yeah.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, citizen Jason Atkinson, representing Southern Oregon. I come here very quickly to put in my strong objection to Section 7 of this bill. I realize there is no sacred cows in this budget environment, but being that Oregon is still a western state, cattle rustling will still get you shot, and I'm here to shoot. I don't like this portion of the bill because this is one of the most successful projects that we did in 2001. The Crater Lake license plate is perhaps the fastest-selling vanity license plate in America. The funds that were raised from it went directly to the National Park Foundation to be used for educational projects at Crater Lake. The funds were loaned to the state of Oregon by Klamath County because the state did not want to assume the risk. So Klamath County made the loan, and the loan was paid back in half the time it was originally thought because the plate sold so well.
All right.
So I am just here not to be passionate, but to tell you that this was on my radar to make sure that this didn't come up. And so as the bill will come back, and I'm certain, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a different form, I am here just to take 2 minutes to say I hope that Section 7 does not come back when it does come back before your committee.
Thank you, Senator, and I would remark that I have never seen you passionate about anything, even floating down the river with you fishing,
yes,
which is one of your great passions. So it is good to have you here. I can assure you probably what's going to happen with this piece of legislation is we're probably going to amend the bill to become a task force to continue studying noxious weeds in the next interim. That's basically what this bill is going to end up being. So Section 7, I can assure assure you will be gone.
Smashing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, are we on House Bill 3308?
We are.
Charge on seed dealers, and we're talking about fishing and...
Well, there's that's all going to be explained shortly.
Cattle prodding or something?
Well, not cattle prodding yet, but who knows. Thank you, Senator. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The chair would like to call Hillary Abraham. Hillary, I'm going to put you in the hot seat first. Yes, I know. You're so appreciative of that. Welcome, Hillary, and for the benefit of the committee, why don't you just share with them how this whole work group on noxious weeds came about and what your group did during the interim, all the hard work and time they put in trying to get your arms around this very important issue.
Great. Welcome. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hillary Abraham. I am the Director of Government Relations for the Nature Conservancy of Oregon. And I'm here today both in that capacity as well as a member of the Noxious Weed Task Force that helped put together the iteration of legislation that is before you today. I'll just simply start by saying that in addition to being, I think, one of the greatest threats to the economic health of the state of Oregon, noxious weeds do represent one of the greatest threats to the state's biodiversity and natural resource health as well. That impact is growing and will continue to grow unless the state of Oregon makes a concerted effort to address this issue now. A first step was made to address noxious weeds through the development of Oregon State Noxious Weed Strategic Plan, which I have here today. That plan was created as a product of a collaborative effort involving 69 private and public groups and agencies representing state and federal, county, and local governments, tribes, and private organizations across the state of Oregon. Upon adoption of this plan during the 2001 state legislative session, then Chairman Representative Krupp of the House Ag Committee formed the Noxious Weed Task Force to help explore funding sources to help implement the plan. That task force was made up of a full range of organizations. I served on the task force, as well as members of the Cattlemen's Association, the Farm Bureau, Association of Oregon Counties, and other representatives from throughout the state. The work group met during the 2002 interim as instructed and sought to accomplish a number of objectives through this process, including the identification of a sustainable funding source to help reinvigorate those counties which no longer had resources to address local weed issues, funding not necessarily reliant on general funds, funding tied to the introduction of weeds, as well as funding that did not disproportionately burden any one constituent group over another, but rather spread the cost among a number of interests. Upon identifying a host of potential funding sources, the group established a process for distributing the funds. The bulk of dollars were to be distributed by the State Weed Board and for use in education, research, technical assistance, incentive programs, as well as some funds for prevention. The goal, however, was to ensure this money was allocated to local communities who would be made eligible for funds based on locally driven management plans. Other funds were to be allocated for the following: interagency coordination on weed control, support for an extension noxious weed specialist at Oregon State University, technical assistance and management to Portland State University to provide technical assistance for its aquatic weed program. The original fiscal impact for this legislation was $8.9 million for the biennium. The following is a sampling of the funding sources that we submitted as options to Legislative Council. The first was a weed control fee on light and heavy trailer, travel trailer, campers, and RV licenses, the dedication of a percentage of new highway construction projects, an out-of-state driver license and vehicle transfer fee, the redirection of unclaimed off-road fuel tax refunds, a fee on imported seed and nursery stock, and a surcharge on container shipments entering Oregon. Unfortunately, the work group did not have the benefit of legal counsel in advance of identifying these funding sources, and so after submitting a draft of our legislation to Legislative Council, we learned the very sources of funding we had hoped would produce the greatest revenue, namely the transportation-related sources, are already constitutionally dedicated. Oops. The legislation you have then before you today represents the funding sources which remain. And as written, as you, Mr. Chair, have already suggested, this legislation is fairly incomplete at this time. It fails to raise even a fraction of the revenue we would need to create a statewide program to wholly address the impact on noxious weeds have. And furthermore, it does violate the work group's policy of disproportionately burdening a small set of constituent groups. So therefore, Mr. Chair, I would ask that you redirect the work group to go back to the drawing board and begin to explore other more viable sources to address this problem. I would also ask that we be provided legal counsel in some form to help advise us through the process so we are able to make better and more informed recommendations to you when we report back. Thank you very much for your time and consideration, and also for acknowledging that this issue is a very important one for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Hillary. Members, questions? Representative Gilman.
Thank you. Section 7 of the bill, I hope that what's happened in the last couple of days is a pretty good indicator to you that that's not a good place to look for money.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, absolutely. We recognize that the Crater Lake license plate renewal is dedicated to the parks, and we are certainly happy to be respectful of that.
Members, any further questions? Thank you, Hillary.
Thank you.
Chair, I'd like to call Commissioner Steve West. Yeah. Welcome, Commissioner. Good to see you again.
Always good to see you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Vice Chairman Gilman will tell you that on Monday I was very passionate. Today I've driven 250 miles, so I'm tired, but still as passionate. I'm here to testify against, briefly, Section 7 of this bill. I'm wearing several hats today. I'm first of all representing the Klamath County Board of Commissioners. I'm also representing myself and Crater Lake Park Superintendent Chuck Lundy as the two petitioners for the original legislation that created this bill. And I'm also representing a small but growing group of constituents who now number over 25,000 owners of Crater Lake license plates. I understand the concern and need for controlling noxious weeds. Klamath County is very dedicated to that mission. We currently allocate over $200,000 a year for noxious weed control on state, federal, and public land and private lands. But the Crater Lake license plate, as you heard from Senator Atkinson, is the most successful plate in the history of Oregon. May well be the most successful specialty plate in the nation, and also brought new technology that the state of Oregon had never had and is extremely popular with our state police. Crater Lake National Park is the only national park in the state of Oregon, and as such, is universally loved by Oregonians. Superintendent Lundy will tell you that in his over 20 years in the National Park Service, he has never seen this relationship between Oregonians have with Crater Lake National Park. He's never seen the intensity of that relationship with any other national park. This project, this license plate project, has been recognized and praised by Senator Wyden, Senator Smith, Congressman Walden, Secretary of Interior Gail Norden, and Director of National Park Service Fran Minella. And as you've heard, Klamath County provided the financing to make this license plate go. I'm very pleased to hear that this section is going to be taken out of the bill. I trust that that's going to happen. Again, we do understand the need for working on noxious weeds. I would suggest that perhaps the interim committee coordinate with counties, especially counties that are now involved with the Title III and Title II programs that have come from the rural counties program through the Forest Service and the BLM, because there is ample opportunity to fund noxious weed programs, especially through Title III. And perhaps by coordinating with the counties on those funding, that we can increase our battle against noxious weeds. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, questions? Well, Commissioner, I just wanted to point out to you, remember I said that by signing this sheet, your testimony had to be truthful and accurate.
Yes, sir.
Are you sure 250 miles is accurate?
Yes, because I had to stop for a accident on the top of Highway 58 and double back about 30 miles to take the person to some attention that they could receive and get their truck turned back right side off the road. So it was at least 250 miles.
Okay, kudos to you for helping out. Great to have you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your testimony. Chair, I'd like to call Tim Butler, Oregon Department of Agriculture. Welcome, Tim. You're not the farmer Tim Butler I know from Staten, however.
No, I'm not.
Is he kin to the representative?
No relation there either.
Okay. Very good.
Tim and Tom.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is Tim Butler. I'm the manager of the Noxious Weed Control Program at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'm here today representing the department to provide some input on House Bill 3308. Hillary Abraham provided a good overview of the task force and what was accomplished there during the interim period. The Noxious Weed Funding Task Force worked hard during that session, that interim period, developing an array of funding options. And we were looking at options that would tie back to the source of the problems, as far as trying to tie that to both ways that weeds are introduced and are also spread. And so came up with that menu. But as far as House Bill 3308, it was not the outcome that we would have hoped for. And in light of the current budget, state budget situation in the state, the department recognizes that House Bill 3308 is not viable to move forward in its current form. However, noxious invasive weeds continue to be a problem, which has been stated. And as a critical natural resource issue statewide, is one of our most important issues I feel that we need to be working on. And we need to continue that ongoing commitment. The department, in conjunction with stakeholders under legislative guidance, would like to continue efforts in identifying viable sources of funding to support this important effort. And this effort is essential for implementing the Oregon Noxious Weed Strategic Plan, as was mentioned, and to protect Oregon's natural resources and economy. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Tim. Members, questions? How big is the problem? How much money do we need to fix it?
Well, we came up with, we're looking at about $8 million a biennium, roughly. And so it's, in this difficult budget times, that's obviously a lot of money. But the problem itself, the economic analysis that we did do, represented approximately an $83 million a year impact to Oregon's economy. And that was just on 21 of our 98 state-listed noxious weeds. So it's a very significant problem from not only an economic standpoint, but also an environmental standpoint.
Okay. Tim, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative.
I kind of brought a question to my mind. Thank you. You're saying it's about an $8 million program a year. This isn't a type of thing that ever gets any better. I understand it probably would not ever go away, but do you see any lessening in the amount that it will cost to control after?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, to answer your question, it can get better. We need to have a continuous, stable base of funding to support counties and local programs, and as well as a good statewide program and effort on noxious weeds. And we currently It's been, as far as some of the economic work that has been done, as far as early intervention programs in particular, have proven a 33-to-1 cost-to-benefit ratio. So for every dollar spent, you get a $33 return as far as being able to prevent and keep these problems in check. So it we can make some headway.
Sure. You know, what might be helpful, Tim, is that when we hear this bill again to move it forward in terms of a task force concept, it might be helpful if you bring us that short film presentation or PowerPoint presentation that you have regarding noxious weeds. In answer to your question, Representative, there is a Scotch broom, especially in some places of eastern Oregon, is taking over. And it really is a very serious problem. So maybe we can arrange that short presentation, maybe 10 or 15 minutes, to get everybody back up to speed on this issue. Because I think it's important that we keep moving forward with trying to find some solutions to this and not let this get totally beyond our control.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. And Mr. Butler, could we get this report about what we have accomplished? And show me how you determine the 33-to-1 category, but out of the 21 out of 98 weeds that we've gotten, I'd just like to be more knowledgeable if I could have that report.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we would be happy to provide that to you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I think that's great.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it. Keith Levitt, Port of Portland. Welcome, Keith. Good to have you here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland. And when I first saw the bill last week, it was the first time I saw it. It became a noxious bill for me. But I do appreciate the kind of how this got here. It obviously is a noble effort. We would have concerns if the sections in there regarding shipping containers were left in the bill, and would ask folks to think about the nexus between that activity and noxious weeds. We do a lot of different types of containers. It's not just imports. In fact, import containers are the smallest part of the business at the Port of Portland. And if you apply a dollar to that, you get about $30,000. That falls a little short of the $9 million goal. So I appreciate how these funding mechanisms were looked at and kind of put together in the bill that you have before you. One other thing we would ask proponents as they think about how to fund this from a port perspective is to look at the competitive trade-offs that we would be doing as we look at containerization and how difficult it is for us just to maintain a container business at the port. We stand ready to work with the proponents of the bill to explain those issues. Finally, there is, as I understand, there are a couple other areas that could be coordinated with this effort, perhaps in a more effective way, and that's the Invasive Species Task Force that was created as a result of legislation last session. There was also a ballast water task force. I think they call it Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force. That worked all interim, similar thing. I think all three groups did a lot of good work and probably hit a bit of a got high centered because of funding. And the port participated in the invasive species work as well as the ballast water task force. So I think coordinating all three of these areas would probably be something that's worthwhile.
Well, Keith, I think actually that's a pretty good idea. One quick question: do you think that there probably are some weeds that wind their way into Oregon through the port just from the normal course of doing business?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is probably a safe assumption without having a lot of knowledge on the issue.
All right. Representative Nelson, you want a quick question?
Well, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Levitt, I'm a little bit concerned about that, too. And I don't understand that the dollar port surcharge on shipping containers offloaded in the state. I understand that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, and I think the issue there would be just to define what that means to be offloaded in the state. For instance, at the Port of Portland, we offload containers from rail, we offload from truck, we offload from barge. In fact, most of our containers are loaded and sent to foreign markets. We're an export port, and the products are Oregon products generally, Northwest and Oregon products. There is a small percentage of our imports that, again, I think is probably the area that you would draw some connections here. But it's a very small percentage of our shipping business is on the import side, and 10% of our imports, for instance, are empty containers that are being repositioned around the West Coast. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, so I guess that my question, Mr. Chair, was these are offloaded anywhere. I mean, not necessarily. I mean, it's offloaded in the state. You mean at the port?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, that would be another ambiguity in the way the bill is drafted that would have to be cleaned up, because we wouldn't have the Port of Portland would not have the authority to go impose something at, for instance, any other port in Oregon if it were offloaded there.
I wanted to be sure that we clarified that, nor off of any other vehicle, trucks or anything else, right, or trains or so that.
Well, most likely all of this language will certainly be deleted from this bill. In the future, though, that is a relevant concern, Representative, for any in really approaching the essence of this whole issue is where, by what means are invasive weed species arriving in the state of Oregon, and how do we try to slow that down, and how do we try to find a way of paying for that that makes sense and is certainly constitutional and legal. So it's a well-timed thoughts. Thank you, Keith. Appreciate it. Chris Jarmer, Oregon Forest Industries. Chris? And last but certainly not least, after him will be Mark Simmons. Welcome, Chris. How are you?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Jarmer. I work for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. And I've heard everything that transpired, and I won't bore you with reiterating all that. Although I did want to be somewhat passionate about the impact that invasive species have on forest landowners. And I know you know that. Just trying to make sure that it stays front and center. Your example about scotch broom for a forester, scotch broom is a dirty word, and we don't like to hear that, or blackberry. So I'm just kind of wanted to make sure that that stayed up on everybody's radar screen. Appreciate all the work that everybody's been done. Our members are ready to help out in any way we can as well. So that's all I had. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. Mr. Simmons, sir. Not very often I get to call you sir anymore.
Well, thank you very much for your giving me just an opportunity to say a brief word. The subject of House.
And who are you, sir?
I am.
All right.
For the third time today. Okay. My name is Mark Simmons. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Nurserymen. And the issue that the bill addresses is a frustrating and difficult problem. Season after season, as we have failed to adequately address this problem, the weeds continue to spread, and particularly in areas of low moisture. That's moisture that could be used to and put to much more productive use than being sucked out of the ground by a weed. And so this is an issue that I have some personal passion about. However, having said that, the bill as worded, we do not support, but are happy to collaborate with others in finding some solutions to this problem that will benefit Oregon.
All right. Thank you very much. Members, questions? Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, members, this is an extraordinarily important issue because invasive weeds not only damage rural economies, they also damage ecosystems. And there is a proper balance in nature when it comes to these things. And clearly, invasive weed species tip the balance improperly, and it creates a real problem, real issue. So we're going to move forward with some type of concept here that keeps the issue alive. And with that, I thank you all very much and hope that you are all willing to continue working on this issue as it sounds you are, because we'll talk about this a little bit further. And with that, we're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3308. Representative Smith, how much time do you have?
5 minutes.
David, how many people are signed up for 2416, please?
I can come back if you call me.
One? Okay. may not be necessary.
Okay.
We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2416. Thank you very much. The chair would like to call David Schmierbach, State Police. Did I say that right?
Very good.
Well, good deal. Welcome, David. Thank you for coming by today.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Schmierbach. I'm the interim director of your Forensic Services Division, Department of State Police. I'm here to speak to you today about the bill on the definition of science. The proposed definition of science is incomplete as written and does not encompass the majority of the life sciences or the applied research sciences. Now, to not make this too complicated, essentially what this proposed definition could be most easily described as is a definition for discovery science. Forensic science, on the other hand, is best described as an applied science. And forensic science does not test laws and theories. So what does that might mean for the Forensic Services Division? Well, to start with, if this definition became statute, our experts, the forensic scientists giving testimony, may have to go through what is called a Brown decision hearing, or at the federal level, it's called a Daubert hearing. And this is essentially where the courts try to mesh law and science and try to get a good understanding how those work together, because historically they have not often meshed well together. And in these hearings, science is basically put through a test to see if it passes legal muster. So if we have a definition that's incomplete and we go through these hearings, we potentially have a chance to have more of these hearings, which incur additional costs, and a possibility for an unnecessary rejection of the forensic science based upon this incomplete definition. I'm neutral as a department and with the division on the actual purpose of the bill. I just wanted to let you know of the potential side effect of this bill. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. David, it was my understanding that the state police forensics had had a conversation with our legal counsel, and that the issue of expert opinion was not an issue, and it was legal counsel's opinion that did not create a problem for you. That's not your understanding, is that correct?
That discussion occurred between your legal counsel and our quality assurance manager. What that discussion concluded with is we were to seek our legal counsel and to determine whether your counsel was giving us the same information that ours would. We've started that process, but they're very busy reacting to other things right now. We have not completed that. However, in our initial telephone conversations, I believe the conversation went something to the effect that, well, you know, lawyers, they can argue anything. But I have not received anything back from our legal counsel yet.
Okay. So, all right.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative, and then Representative Beyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Schmierbach. Where did you get the term discovery?
Discovery? That's out of a college text that we have there in the division headquarters.
Of what?
I'm sorry? It's a general science text.
Could you supply me with the...
Sure.
Thank you.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to clarify whether you're addressing the bill or the amendment, the Dash 1 amendment, the definition, and which of these are you... Or have you even seen the Dash 1 amendment?
I personally have not seen the Dash 1 amendment.
So you're referring to the existing House?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Actually, that brings up a good point, Representative Beyer, in that the proponents of the bill have decided that they would like to remain with the original printed bill as opposed to adopting either the Dash 1s or the Dash 2s. And so based on that, it had been the chair's understanding that this issue had been resolved in terms of the points you brought forward in regard to expert testimony. And so with that, we'll have to move on.
Mr. Chairman, if I do hear back from legal counsel, I'll make sure I get a hold of your office and let you know.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Members, based on that testimony, I think it is in our wisdom that we hold on to this bill a little bit further and continue to work it just a bit more so that we can be sure that we've satisfied the relevant concerns here. And with that, we're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2416. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3123. And Ray, you want to tell us what this bill is about?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3123 removes the prohibition against recording a brand on the jaw of a cattle. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Oregon Revised Statute Chapter 604.021 prohibits a brand of any kind from being placed on the jaw of a cattle, and this measure simply changes that. And you will note that there is a typographical error in the last sentence of the background. It should read 3123, not 2123, and we'll correct that.
Okay, thank you, Ray. Katie Fast, come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Krupp, members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fast, representing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. The OCA requests the passage of 3123, which removed the prohibition currently against the Oregon Department of Agriculture to record a brand registered for use on the jaw of cattle. And I have added a picture of where this area is for those that might not be familiar on the second page of my testimony. A recorded livestock brand is the only recognized proof of ownership by the state of Oregon for cattle. A brand is not only recorded by its pictorial, but also by the species it will be used on and also the location which it will be placed. And also on that second page, it shows that there are four, like an example, there are four people using the same brand. They just use it on different species and on different locations of cattle. The prohibition was in place due to USDA's exclusive use of the area for Mexican feeder cattle coming into the United States and also cattle that have been exposed to tuberculosis and brucellosis. That placement of those animals, their branding mark has now been moved to the hip, the upper hip near the tailhead of cattle. USDA is no longer using the jaw brand to mark these animals. There would be two benefits that our membership is requesting these branding placement for. One, it would just open up a new area of usage and allow them to apply for brands and more options for the membership. The second is a possible financial benefit for some people. As our industry is changing the way they market cattle and people are retaining ownership of their calves all the way to harvest, the hide price is sometimes a factor, and a brand can discount the value of an animal's hide and therefore impact the price that a producer is paid. This practice of branding's jaw is currently allowed in horses and sheep, and we're just allowing the use in cattle as well as our request. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Katie. Members, questions? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me why the prohibition was passed originally?
Representative Worth, Chair Krupp, is my understanding that it was a perceived concern by animal welfare groups that put pressure on USDA to move to possibly a less sensitive area.
Can I follow up, Mr.
Yes.
So this is the jaw, and is this a cattle?
That would be
that's a longhorn yoking steer or something.
a quick internet find of a picture of a cow. I don't believe we have that breed in Oregon.
Representative Wirtz, you beat me to the punch.
Funny. Good job. Thanks.
All right. Members, any additional questions of Katie?
After that?
Katie, thank you. Thank Roger you. Huffman, you're up next. Members, it's the chair's intention to move this bill as soon as possible. And so, Roger, your comments.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Roger Huffman, Administrator of the Animal Health and Identification Division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Essentially, what I was going to talk about the history and why the prohibition in the state law and those issues, the reservations that we have had in the past on this particular issue on cattle, Katie has explained quite well. So I see no reason to be redundant, and I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Roger, you guys good to go with this as a department?
Mr. Chairman, we don't really see from a physical problem, I think it would identify the animals well because of this small area and stuff. We've let the persons that are interested in this know that just like it's allowed right now to do it on the neck of cattle, it's not the best area. It's allowed on horses. There's about a half of a dozen out of 1,900 friends that are recorded that are actually used on the jaw because it's not a normal place that people look, and it's really not easy to see. So it's it would be an acceptable method versus no brand at all. So, yes, we would be willing to allow this.
Thank you, Roger. And with that, we're going to conclude a public hearing on House Bill 3123 and open a work session on House Bill 23. Representative Smith, you have a motion, don't you?
Yes, I do. I would like to move House Bill 3123 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Members, a motion is made to move House Bill 3123 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Any no, I'm not going to do that. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. House Bill 3123 is hereby passed to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, and Representative Patty Smith will be the carrier.
Thank you,
members, very much. We're going to close the work session on 3123. We're going to open. We need to call Representative Zahner's office.
Oh, it's time for me to go.
It's time for you to go now. Thankfully. Members, we're going to stand at ease until Representative Zahner gets down here, and we'll talk about his issue and move forward.
I think we should talk about it before he gets here. My branding iron would not...
Meeting is called back to order. Welcome to Representative's Honor. Come forward, please. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3132. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What are we doing here today?
Representative's Honor from District 22. We're going to work on an Agricultural Protection Act. It is not a swan hunt. It is not. Representative Worth. The bill 3132 very simply specifies the trumpeter swan as a game bird. As you may be aware, Oregon is a home to two types of swans, the trumpeter and the tundra swan. The trumpeter swans, which is I like to classify as a good swan, is protected, would remain classified as a game bird. House Bill 3132 is just the first but a necessary step in recognizing the nature of swans and the impact these large birds have on Oregon's environment and economy. The Willamette Valley, with its temperate climate and abundant grass seed fields, provide a great spot for these migrating waterfowl to stop for the winter. Adult swans can eat up to 9 kilograms of food each per day, and they're not choosy. They'll eat roots, stems, leaves, seeds. Hopefully some will even eat some of those noxious weeds you have. Their strong legs and large webbed feet with long, sharp claws are used to dig up roots or produce water currents that wash the mud away from the roots. Grass seed farmers in the Willamette Valley can lose up to 35% or more of their grass seed fields to the appetites of these birds annually. Swans can also cause harm if threatened, especially during nesting season between April and June. The eating habits of swans demand that each pair defend a large territory. The bill of a swan is a dangerous weapon that can be used for causing deep wounds. These birds also use their wings, and they can hit as hard as a man with a doubled fist. An angry swan is dangerous to people and will attack. As you can see here, we have some stuff that came off the internet. Township puts out contract on crazed bird. A criminal swan has driven people in Grand Haven, Michigan batty, forcing the township board to put a contract out on the berserk bird. You read through these things, they can challenge you. There was also one that attacked a grandmother during the last session that, you know, when I talked to this committee. But anyway, I'd invite you to read that. Seriously, I've tried to think of a way to sugarcoat this bill, but the reality is that these birds are destroying grass seed fields, which in turn causes farmers to lose money as well as our state. They're destructive to agricultural crops, products, and activities, but cannot be considered predatory because they are now game birds. Reality is, however, these birds are not game birds. We don't hunt them now, and to my knowledge, there has never been a swan season in Oregon. House Bill 3132 will not create a hunting season. It will only allow tundra swans the potential to be considered predatory. Questions?
Thank you, Representative. If we consider tundra swans predatory, what does that do? Does that allow ODF and W to manage them differently?
As I understand it, it would allow them to maybe do that. There is some federal guidelines, and they will testify afterwards. But it would allow the farmer the opportunity to protect his land and treat the tundra as a predator like they would a coyote, any other kind of animal like that. There's only a few farmers that are having this problem, as you know, Representative, but they do cluster. And I don't want a hunting season on them. I want an agricultural act maybe that we can develop later on that would allow those farmers somehow to control those swans. But we have to make this maneuver to get that endangered one, the trumpeter, the good swan, out of that area so it won't be hunted. That swan won't be hunted.
So, for the record, it is not your intention to allow this bill to be used as a pretext or a precursor to opening up or instituting a never previously before conducted tundra swan hunt. Is that correct?
That's correct. I have 10 grandkids, and as soon as they heard last session that I was going to shoot swans, they wouldn't talk to me for a couple of weeks. And it was not my intent.
Okay. Okay, members, questions of the good word. Yes, Representative Worth, I knew you'd step in here somehow.
And this does seem tactical, Representative. Go ahead.
I'm just curious about what's your understanding of the federal laws according in the
We have an overlay, and I'd like the ODF and W people to talk about that overlay. There are some things we can and can't do. We tried to do some things last session, but to move the birds around so that we could handle them like we do geese, but we had some overlays that we couldn't do that. And so after working with legislative counsel and also ODF and W, they decided this might be the best way to go. So that's kind of a start.
Very good, Representative and members. I'll declare a potential conflict of interest, as I am one of the farmers in the Grass Seed Valley who has experienced severe crop pressure from swans, not geese, but rather from swans, incidentally. And that is a rather unique circumstance because there are only certain places in the valley that the swans tend to congregate in large areas. It is interesting that since I have since sold that farm and moved north to just east of Salem, that the other day on my new farm there are some rocks that are painted. I thought I could get away from these creatures, but we have some rocks painted white out in the middle of the field so that the farmer who's renting my place cannot hit them when he's out working the field. And sure enough, out comes a swan and lands among them.
Mr. Chair, in this article here, this same family has been harassed by that swan for 3 years. So maybe they recognize you, and I don't know. But, I mean, even now when they're on jet skis, that same swan attacks them.
Okay, well, I don't have any jet skis, but
it's your pet now,
it must be. They're just following me. It's my lot in life.
They must have a great memory, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, they must. They must be marvelous animals with a great memory. All right, thank you, Representative. We appreciate it. Ron Anglin and Eric Rickerson, ODF. F&W, come forward, please, if you would. I did say your last name correctly, didn't I, Eric? All right, good. Welcome. What are your thoughts on this issue today?
Good afternoon, Chair Krupp, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator, ODFW. We have a couple of different points that we'd like to make as far as clarification on the bill for you today. The main one is that federal regulations still would apply no matter what the designation that the legislature would make as far as the status of the bird here in the state. And with those federal regulations, if any kind of take were to be allowed, we would have to go through an EIS process with federal government that would define take and the different steps that could be taken either by the federal government or the state before any take could occur.
Now, Ron, back up a moment. You're talking about trumpeter or tundra swans?
I'm talking about swans in general, Chair Krupp.
Why would there be a take issue on the federal side if that is that under Migratory Bird Act or is that under Endangered Species?
Chair Krupp, swans in general are covered under the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and any change in status within the state would not change their federal designation. So we would still have to operate under the rules and regulations of the federal act. And
requires an economic impact survey, correct?
Environmental impact statement.
Environmental.
Chair Krupp, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
It, because we have never had any seasons here in Oregon or done anything with tundras, in order to do anything from a damage standpoint or anything like that, we would have to go through a federal process that would allow us to do that, similar to what we've done with Northwest Oregon geese and some things like that.
Okay.
The second thing that the bill does, members of the committee, is that all swans currently are classified as game birds, And what this bill does is it leaves the trumpeter classified as a game bird, and then the tundra swan would be removed from that classification. And within our own rules, it would then be classified as non-game wildlife. And under the non-game wildlife designation in OAR, it would fall under the protected wildlife, which the commission still has regulatory capability over as long as it fits within any federal framework and the regulations that the federal government have allowed us to operate under, which at this point in time with swans is none. I think with that, I'd like to go ahead and conclude my portion of the testimony, and Eric could probably provide you with a little bit of background as far as swan populations in the state.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Eric Rickerson, also from the Wildlife Division, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I just thought I'd like to give you a little bit of background on the biology of the bird, just to kind of set this context for you. As Representative Zahner mentioned in his testimony, there are two species of swans that occur here in the state and throughout the western U.S., and that is the tundra and the trumpeter. Both are present in Oregon. During the winter time, they usually migrate in the fall, leave about this time of the year, and nest primarily in Alaska. They do look very similar in appearance, except for some slight size difference, and they both intermix on the wintering ground, so it can be very difficult to tell between the two. To give you an idea of how many birds we're looking at, this past year in January, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service counted slightly over 2,400 birds just in the Willamette Valley alone, with a statewide estimate of slightly over 7,600. That 2,400 bird estimate is down slightly from the 10-year average of about 2,771, so it's right within the range of what we've seen in the last 10 years. And those numbers fluctuate really as a result of open water in states and provinces to the north of us as cold weather pushes them down but come to Oregon. The bulk of the birds, about 75% of the population of tundras, move on through the state and winter in Central Valley of California. And so right now, because of the tenuous nature of trumpeter swans, which there has been lawsuits in the past over some of the tundra hunting in Nevada, Utah, and Montana, there was concern about incidental take of trumpeters since they do winter together. Right now, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has designated the trumpeter as a species of management concern, and they have stated that the tundra population has been increasing since 1949 when they began their surveys, and they estimate the last 10 years about 80,000 birds found in the western U.S. So from their standpoint, hunting of those birds in other states has been justified. But as Mr. Englund alluded to allow any kind of take, including hunting seasons in the state, we'd have to go through an EIS since no seasons have occurred. And with that, I'd just like to conclude our testimony and be happy to answer any questions you have.
So if we reclassify this bird, what does it really mean in reality? How does it help that farmer at all? What happens here?
Mr. Chair, if we classify it at the state level, at the state definition, whether it's game bird or not, we still have to go through the federal hoops, if you will, working with their Migratory Bird Management Office, developing an environmental impact study. They've already alluded to that it would take 2 to 3 years in which to do that, in which it would go through a large public review process. And so to allow any take, and that would be whether a farmer wanted to be able to go out on their back property and take one bird to, you know, scare the flock, or if the agency wanted to issue depredation or kill permits, those same federal regulatory hurdles we'd still have to jump over. So it's regardless of the state definition at this point, because it is a migratory bird, and as you were correct in alluding to, it's under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
Okay, so changing the status in reality doesn't mean anything until your department would choose to do an EIS, correct? And then you could allow damage take, as we have done with geese in the valley, correct?
Chair Krupp, that's correct if the federal government found through the EIS process that that was an allowed activity.
They could make the decision to say that we don't think that this is a bigger problem as, say, geese, and we don't think that under the EIS results of their study that it actually merits allowing take.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
That would be their option.
That would be their option to determine the impact that the bird's having and what any kind of take would have on the population. What they would be looking at primarily is because trumpeters do occur in mixed flocks and they're very difficult to tell, they would be looking at more the impact likely to trumpeter swans. And as I mentioned, I gave you tundra swan numbers. They are difficult to discern, but when they've had trained individuals out there looking at them, there may be as few as 50 birds in the entire Willamette Valley at one time. And that's only because the birds were neck collared. There was a plastic marker in the neck so they could discern between those and tundra. So to give you an idea of the hunting seasons, how tightly regulated they have become in those other states, all swans that are harvested, and it is by a permit system, have to go to a mandatory check station where they do a physical examination on the bird. Each state, particularly Utah and Nevada, now have quotas, and once they reach a total of 20 trumpeter swans incidentally taken, they shut down their tundra swan hunting. So the states and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have come under a great deal of pressure from outside forces on the seasons.
Okay. Members? Question? Representative Nelson and then Representative Worth.
Thank you very much. Mr. Rickerson and Mr. Englund, do we have any sort of economic damages provision in any of our management of fish and wildlife that says, you know, when we find that out here with my cats, you know, dogs, anything that are causing a certain amount of economic damage, I mean, that we need to have an emergency clause? I mean, do we have that in any practicality of our state laws or federal laws?
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, I'm not sure I understand exactly. Are you referring to compensation or
no,
are you referring?
Excuse me, I'll clarify it for
okay.
you. Okay. I mean, let's say if a farmer's losing 85% of his crops because of a certain species of animal or bird or whatever, I mean, is there any economic damages law that allows protection of the poor landowner?
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, for those species that are totally under the state's control, we have a broad latitude under our wildlife damage statutes to go in and assist the landowner to help them solve the problem. It gets tougher when you have the federal overlay because we have to fit within whatever the federal regulations will allow us to do. And in this particular case, they're very narrow, very restrictive, and we can't do much of anything.
Mr. Chair, can you give me an estimate of time which you would think it would take to go through this process if the state of Oregon decided to get an EIS statement from the federal government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, in our conversations with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they said the time frame could be anywhere from 18 to 36 months, and a lot of it depends on extenuating factors, the number of, like I said, trumpeter swans maybe that could be incidentally taken, the scope of the public meetings that would be involved, the level of maybe previous work that has been done at the flyway level, in which we're a member of 11 western states that work with the Fish and Wildlife Service and management of these birds. So it can really vary, but 2 to 3 years is a good time estimate before we could even address any kind of take whatsoever.
Paula? Yes, please.
And so, you know, I'm sensitive to the practicality in distinguishing the two swans. And tell me how much of a problem it would be as if we as a state passed this distinction in terms of game bird and not game bird, and then passed that law and then but yet not being able to really treat them differently until this EIS study was done. And I mean, would we in fact be telling farmers one thing without, you know, would we cause confusion and then make people think that they could in fact, you know, manage these birds on their property and then violate the federal laws?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, that is a distinct possibility, particularly if they were moved under the category of predatory animal. That may send a false message. However, if that were to occur, us as an agency would have to get the word out to our constituents and others, working with the Farm Bureau and other folks, letting them know just because the state definition had changed, they still would have to work with the department and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to address any kind of depredation concerns. So it we just have to be very careful that everybody understood that there's really no change in what we can do as far as management of swans. One thing I did want to add is that, to kind of address Representative Nelson's question, what we've tried to do, we work closely with Wildlife Services, a branch of the USDA, and it is their responsibility to address waterfowl or migratory bird damage concerns, and so issues where swans come up, as the chair has properly put, they're very habitual in their use, and so when we document these, or Wildlife Service does, we try to keep that on our front burner, and every year when the swans show up, try to throw resources at that, if you will, to haze birds, but unfortunately you are then spreading the problem or moving it to another landowner, and they tend to come back, so you've unfortunately got to keep on top of it. So we try to address it from at least hazing the birds and keeping them off the landowners and minimizing damage, if you will.
Just a quick last question to her chin. Just kidding. Mr. Richardson saying, you know, I haven't been a part of it. Contracts, I mean, where we've gone to Africa to kill sparrows, you know, to be able to grow crops to feed the people. I mean, isn't there any common practical sense to the application of prudent practices when it comes to raising food? I mean, here we are, the hungriest state, you know, no jobs and hungry, but yet we let a bird, you know, eat the grass seed. I mean, just to me, this is just so strange that we don't have any provisions of common sense, but yet we can fly to Africa and do it with our helicopters. I don't know. I'm just curious, have we ever gone to the you know, gone to the rescue of individuals trying to furnish jobs so we're not the most jobless state, our food so we're not the hungriest state?
Chair Krupp.
And did the federal government understand the issue, I guess?
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, again, we take very aggressive action for those species that we have full management authority over. And as you have expressed, there can be a great deal of frustration in working within the federal system and what is allowed or not allowed. And the federal government has not relaxed any of the rules at this point in time relative to swans.
Have we ever made the last follow-up? Have we ever declared an emergency in this state and done, you know, what was prudent and practical? It reminds me of the fires or a gypsy moth or spruce budworm or, you know, any of these others. You know, it makes me sad that we could have killed the medfly in California the year before it took, you know, $40 billion of dollars of food out of everybody's mouth. We could have done it the year before, but we have to wait for all this red tape or whatever it's called, you know, to come to practical, what's the word, steps, I guess. Have we ever declared an emergency other than a forest fire, which is always too late? We'd rather, you know, lose the resource than, you know, say up front we're going to do this and protect our timber. Have we ever declared anything like this? We don't do it for the fish, right?
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, I'm unaware of the state ever doing anything like that.
But we have representative, and actually that's a good point you brought up because it leads me to my question for you is how long did it take us to get an environmental impact study on the geese that were causing depredation issues down in the southern part of the valley? How long did that take, and what was the process involved?
Mr. Chair, my memory's a little fuzzy. At the time, I did work with the game bird program on that, and it was longer than the 2 to 3 years. I know this issue had been building since the early 80s when these populations were increasing. It took a great deal of effort on our part in cooperation with the Farm Bureau and others to really show the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that we had a very serious problem here in the Willamette Valley. And our permit goose season is really an experimental season where we can take birds during the month months of February and into March, which is outside normal frameworks, and so we had to jump through a lot of hoops just to get that season. And we've had some success not only harvesting birds, but at least giving landowners the opportunity to have hunters come out and harass birds off their property. But it was a very lengthy process, and one that I'm afraid to say was longer than 2 to 3 years.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to belabor this subject if I could, please, but I just want to point out federal government sending us to Africa. I mean, but yet they can't come to Oregon. I'm just amazed. Okay.
Well, Representative, you bring up a good point. There's a lot of inconsistency in the federal government actions at times. All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. I do appreciate your testimony here today. Members, that's all the testimony we have on this bill today. We're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3132. And the chair is just curious to know how informally what the members think of this concept.
Mr. Chair, I think we've got to move forward. I mean, if we don't urge the federal government to get practical by having, you know, a recommendation like this, they're never, talk about 20 years, pay attention to geese. It'll be, I mean, Representative Zahner will be playing golf in
heaven.
Old folks home. He'll be playing miniature golf by then in the old folks home if we don't do something.
So the effect of passing this bill is that it may be possible at some point in the future to petition the federal government for an EIS on this issue.
Yeah.
The effect is that the EIS may come back with a recommendation from the federal government that the problem isn't big enough to do anything. Or it may come back, as it was with the years of work on the geese predation, that there should be some allowable damage control take. In any event, I don't think that it's rational or reasonable to think that we would ever get a hunting season on these birds.
No, I don't.
Given the issues they're having in other states that are relative to this, where they actually do have hunting seasons. So, I don't know, what do you guys think? It's just informal discussion here.
I'm not ready to advocate shooting swans.
I think that it will be longer than 2 or 3 years, and I'm concerned about passing a state law saying one thing, and then, you know, giving an indication to landowners that you can do this, but no, you can't. So I think that's the problem that we need to worry about, and that legitimacy in the eyes of Oregonians to begin with. And I'm not a landowner, but the gooses are hard enough for me. I can't speak as a landowner, but I'm not ready to do this yet.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we move ahead, and I don't think we're not doing anything to them, but at least it brings somebody's, you know, attention to this issue. I mean, to me, it's like, I just want to ask the question. If I'm talking about rabid swans, can I take them? Rabid, that's the word.
I guess we're going to reopen a public hearing on House Bill 3132 and ask ODF&W that question. That's a fair question. They're covered under the Migratory Bird Act. But
Representative Nelson, once again for the record, Eric Rickerson from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The question of whether you could take a rabid swan would be, I guess, a new one in the fact that I'm not sure swans are even carriers of rabies. And the second thing, regardless of a disease outbreak or an impact to landowners, we would still have to work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to address any take. And that encompasses, you name it, and the off chance there is a human safety concern, you still have to address the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the take of swans.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
But actually, and Representative Worth brings up a point that I wanted to ask you. With the goose predation issue, those birds were also covered under the Migratory Bird Act?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So at some point, they had to be classified similar to this proposal for Oregon to petition the federal government for an EIS to look at depredation and get the limited additional hunting season we have. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's partly correct. As I mentioned earlier in a testimony, regardless of the state definition, the state could call it anything that it wants. And if you approach the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and want to allow take, whether it be hunting or depredation permits, that would be the course of action that you would have to do. With geese, they've always been classified as a game bird here in the state. We had hunting seasons, and so the federal framework is relatively broad on such things such as ducks and geese, and so they allow us some wiggle room in there to set our seasons. When it came to this depredation issue, and particularly at climaxing and, well, continuing to in some areas, we wanted to go outside the normal hunting season or the outside the normal federal framework, and that is sometime late in January. So we had to basically go back to the service and kind of repetition, if you will, work with them, identify season structure, projected number of birds that we were going to take. The fact that one species, the cackling Canada goose, is largely subsisted on by native Alaskans. They were brought into the talk. So it was a huge issue, but one that we did have to go through. But to reiterate, it's really regardless of the state definition. We do have to approach the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on any take.
So do you think that there was an improper message sent to the farmers out there when you went forward with those efforts to seek an EIS and the additional study work over those years, and they went out and killed the geese anyway?
Mr. Chair, I don't think we, from my standpoint, I didn't see that we gave out any kind of improper message or landowners received that as such. We had worked closely with the Oregon Farm Bureau and landowners, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, including the Washington Farm Bureau, and formed a depredation working group and outlined to their representatives what steps we would have to take, that we were going to seek expanding seasons, looking at, you know, and of course the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came back and said, well, to do that, you're going to need to put up check stations and monitor bird harvest. And so I think we had a very good system in place in which we could get the word out that we weren't reclassifying. We were looking at ways to alleviate damage, and that this really is looked at as a depredation hunt and not really a sport hunt. But we use hunting as a tool to alleviate damage on private lands, essentially. And so that's the way we couched it to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and that's really how we've been addressing the program since.
Last question. If we don't reclassify the bird under this proposal, can we or can we not petition the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for an EIS study in regards to depredation?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Regardless of the state definition or status, we could approach them about whether it be through an EIS or just open up the dialogue with, and we would be happy to include the representative in any discussions that we have and lay out the strategy that would have to take place to do that, to make sure he's well aware of what we are doing and how we are addressing the problem, because we do understand there are some landowners that are suffering some significant damage, whether it be geese or swans in the valley.
Okay. Thank you very much. And the chair would like to recall to the stand Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the record,
Representative Cliff Zahner, District 22. Last session, we worked a long time on the swan thing, and we were going to try the taking or the hunt. And ODF&W received death threats. So I'm trying to protect them and trying to work with them. And unless we can find a good way to work into this program, and this seems like a logical way to do it, that it's only on a limited amount of farms. If then later we can go to some kind of a permit where the farmer that's having the trouble can be educated in what a tundra looks like and what a trumpeter looks like, and can do some selective shooting at these swans, because that's what it's going to take. They have great memories. And
they do.
The geese are the same way. A statistic showed when we were hunting the geese all week long, they'd stay off the farm. But then when they started doing it 3 days a week, the geese would stay off until the hunting, those 3 days were over, and then they'd come in and eat the 3 days later. And so I don't know how else to do that, but that then would be an agricultural act that would permit the farmer to kind of protect his own land and proper education, and under their guidance, I think that's the way to do it, because to do a hunt like Idaho and Montana and those states do is not realistic. It won't work. Yeah. And they can tell you about the death threats, and I mean, comes that old swan. It's like Bambi, you know. There's a good deer and a bad deer. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative. And with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3132.
Mr. Chair.
Actually,
I would like to do anything we could to help solve the problem, but I'm not sure this bill does that.
Okay, fair enough. Well, members, I think let's have some continuing discussions about this in the coming days and see if we can find common ground to move forward on a concept that is workable to meet Representative Zahner's concerns, and I think that's fair. And with that, I thank you all very much. Chair's going to open a relatively quick hearing on House Bill 2344. Excuse me, I'm going to close the House Bill or the hearing on House Bill 3132 and open the hearing on House Bill 2344. Members, I drew up some amendments trying to address various concerns, and after having listened to the testimony and looking my notes over. Now, listening to Representative Nelson's concerns and also been reading Department of Forestry's concerns about DAS having the ability to adequately promulgate rules to achieve this outcome, I decided to amend the bill such that we would have each individual agency come forward with a plan, so to speak, as how to achieve this. And David, did you pass those amendments out to the members on House Bill 2344? Okay, and also the Legislative Council's opinion, if you would, please, too. Okay, why don't you go ahead and do that, and we'll pass them out as we're chatting. Legislative Council also wrote me an opinion expressing some discomfort with having individual agencies move forward with this type of a policy because they felt that there would be inconsistencies. And what I did in the amendment, which you'll see in a moment, is to direct each agency that deals with the ownership or management of any state property and state forest lands to develop and adopt rules to expedite timber recovery. And I think we also extended not only timber recovery but environmental recovery at the same time, because they kind of go hand in hand when you have a fire that burns so hot that you bake the soil. And in that, they were concerned that there would not be the consistency. We also directed Department of Administrative Services to develop contract procedures for how each one of those agencies would accomplish that. And they have, and you'll see in their verbiage, they have some concern about contract language and Oregon's contracting provisions. Thank you. So what I wanted to do was put this in front of you and not go through this greatly today, but rather present to you kind of this concept and ideas as an amendment and just get your thoughts about how maybe we can make it a little better. So what I would ask that each one of you do is look at the amendments compared to the original bill and look at Legislative Council's verbiage and give the chair some advice, since this is half of the chair's piece of legislation. And with that, chair would like to call Bill Hooding, come forward if you would, please. Okay. And we have one witness, members, so if you have to leave That'll be all right as soon as he's done. Thank you. Welcome, Bill. Good to see you again.
Chair Krupp and committee, thank you for allowing me to speak in support of House Bill 2344. For the record, I'm Bill Cluding, representing the Western Council of Industrial Workers. We have over 4,000 members in Oregon working in the forest, lumber, and wood products, facilities, and lumber transportation. Chair Krupp, it might take a minute. The other day, Representative Nelson asked how many timber jobs have we lost in Oregon, and let me be the first to say that it takes many factors to trigger a mill closing, but timber supply is right at the top on any mill closing. Recently, the Oregonian ran articles on the 30,000-plus people who has lost their jobs in the timber industry in the 90s, and they could only find half these people. The half they did find, half of them was working in service, in the service field. Sometimes half the pay and very few benefits from what they had in these high-paying jobs in the timber industry. And as Senator Atkinson testified before you the other day, mills are still closing because of timber supply. I like this bill for a number of reasons. I got to change this a little bit right now, but it has only one section and is only four lines long, and so far no amendments. But I'll revise that, sir. And it gets right to the point. Our forestry experts tell us the forests in Oregon are in horrible condition. Fuel load, disease, and lack of proper management are the problem. A forest that is not managed or managed correctly goes through three stages. The first stage is green, the second stage is black, and the third stage is gray. Mm-hmm. For proof, you can go to where the fires were last year, the year before, and the year before, and be ready for more fires this year.
Yep.
Our state forest experts tell us that as soon as the ground cools enough to where it doesn't burn the soles of your boots, that's the time to start the healing process in the forest.
Okay.
We can and need to salvage what usable timber there is very carefully. We can have people and equipment, including helicopters, that can do this work correctly. And then we can put down the grass seed and replant the native species that we lost.
Mm-hmm.
We also need to train more of these types of work crews because they're needed all over the state. This is how you jumpstart a forest back to good health. For a real good example, you can go north to where Mount St. Helens blew and where they drew the lines to where that's a national park and where the neighboring timber companies jumped in and salvaged your timber, planted it back. They have timber, they have trees higher in this room, they have fish in their streams. 50 years from now, we can go back, some of us can go back maybe, and you will not see that in that other area that's still that gray color. This is how you jumpstart the forest back to good health. Healing watersheds and wildlife habitat benefits all people in Oregon, and it could save a mill from closing.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps people working. Lastly, it would set an example to the federal government and give them a model plan to restore our federal forest to a healthy state. Again, I urge you to pass House Bill 2344 as amended. This is a win-win for all the people in Oregon. Thank you, and I will try to answer any questions.
Members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In previous years of forest fires, have we been as dilatory as we are right now? Is this habitual on this side? I'm usually on the other side, so... dilatory delay in saving the salvage. And I mean, is this customary?
It seems like from the late 80s, the process of going through the process of trying to restore a forest or keep a forest in good health winds up into the court process and delay after delay, and pretty soon it's too late.
So you would follow up, Mr. So you would say in the past 25 years, we've just become more dilatory in, for a state, I'm just trying to figure out for a state that is so forestry oriented, where did we go wrong in protecting our precious natural resources?
It's according to what group you're sitting with, Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson.
We could start with the spotted owl, I think.
Yes, sir, that's true. It's time that people in Oregon take a long, long look at what's happened. We are a broke state. Our forests were once in pretty fair condition. They are not now. And I think the whole aspect of this forestry and agriculture in this state needs to have a long look at to bring this state back up to where we once were.
So would you say, this did start with the spotted owl, or did it start after that?
The spotted owl was the trigger. Chair Krupp, yeah. Representative Nelson.
Bill, thanks a lot. I really do appreciate your support. I think you really hit the nail on the head. The figures about laid off timber workers are frankly not good. Even with retraining, it has not been positive. And so there's a lot of work to be done. We appreciate your support. Members, I will thank you for your diligence today. Please look over those amendments and give the chair some good advice about what you think would be a reasonable way to implement this concept. And do it soon, because I'd really like to, if we have to make further adjustments, I'd like to do that quickly and then move the bill forward, if you would.
Does it still have no impact, fiscal impact, with the amendments?
That is actually a good question, Ray.
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, we don't know, because until amendments are adopted into a measure, the fiscal office does not give an estimate. Because it's not part of the legislative measure.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I just want to question, if I could, are we in the work session?
No, we're just in public hearing.
I don't know if I can ask a question or not, but I've
sure.
And I've seen many task forces where a number of agencies and groups have worked together. So I'm questioning why this isn't practical. I mean, does it take the governor to make this happen?
He would need to sign it into law, yes. So it does.
But I mean, to get a task force to move this forward immediately so we get jobs started, since this is his top priority, too.
Well, Representative, I think this committee and the adjoining Senate committee is probably going to be that task force, because our time is getting limited, and your point is very well taken. We need to get this on the ground and get it effective immediately so that agencies can start planning for what is likely to be another bad fire season, and that we have some rules in place by the time that those fires are burning, and the agencies will have some direction about how they can accomplish what we're asking them to do here. And so I the time has passed for us to do task forces. We just need to do this, my opinion.
Mr. Chair, if I just
sure.
But 90 days is July. I mean, it's hot. I mean, we've started fire seasons in March here before. And so
I think
have great concern for expediency.
And to address your concern, because you did that before, I added in Section 2 of the amendment, which is an emergency clause. It'll take effect immediately upon passage. Okay. And with that, members, we're going to close a hearing on House Bill 2344, and we're going to close today's hearing. Thank you all very much.